TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Chalmers Johnson on Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. TUC Radio Archives, Part 2 of 2. Chalmers Johnson's name is reappearing in the 2023 work of analysts and historians. He wrote that nothing is more dangerous to democracy than military expansion and war, and he argued that the U.S. is in danger of internal collapse, due in large part to the vast expenditures required to maintain its ever-expanding empire. And he should have known, as former analyst for the CIA. Here's a TUC radio recording from 2007. Chalmers Johnson died age 79 in late November 2010, after a full and amazing life as author, professor, historian, and scholar on Asia's political economy. During the Cold War, he served as a consultant to the CIA. Later, he became a leading critic of U.S. militarism and empire building, and of his former employer. He had come to understand that empire building and democracy are mutually exclusive. He said, "The political system of the United States, history tells us, is one of the most unstable combinations there is, that is, domestic democracy and foreign empire. The choices are stark. A nation can be one or the other, a democracy or an imperialist. But it can't be both. The United States today is like a cruise ship on the Niagara River, upstream of the most spectacular falls in North America. A few people on board have begun to pick up a slight hiss in the background, and note that the river current seems to be running slightly faster. But no one yet seems to have realized that it is almost too late to head for shore. Like the Chinese, Ottoman, Habsburg, Imperial German, Nazi, Imperial Japanese, British, French, Dutch, Portuguese, and Soviet empires in the last century, we are approaching the edge of a huge waterfall and are about to plunge over it." End of quote. In the last 10 years of his life, Johnson wrote 4 books around that theme: the trilogy Blowback, Sorrows of Empire, and Nemesis, and the 2010 Dismantling the Empire, aptly subtitled America's Last Best Hope. You are about to hear a conversation on stage held in March 2007. Between Chalmers Johnson and Gray Bracken, the author of Imperial San Francisco. The book Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic had just been published. Chalmers Johnson had been featured in the film Why We Fight, which won the 2005 Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. The film describes the rise and maintenance of the military-industrial complex. The tagline of the film is, "It is nowhere written that the American empire goes on forever." Gray Bracken began by asking about that film.
After watching Why We Fight, which is about the military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower warned us, and I believe he left out congressional. I think he was going to put that in.
Well, famously, he intended to say the military-industrial congressional complex, but it was members of Congress who warned him off, we know from his papers. Let me just say about the film, I was very pleased to be included. I do believe Jarecki probably overstates Eisenhower, though. That is, he was the butcher of Guatemala.
Mossadegh.
Certainly the Mossadegh affair. He was easily bamboozled by the British. He had presided over this unbelievable growth of the military-industrial complex, particularly the Air Force, and it appalled him when he realized that it was now out of control, and that moreover, it was starting to penetrate deeply into the society. It's perfectly logical for the Secretary of Defense to want to close military bases that are redundant useless or go back to the Civil War. Every time he tries it, it would happen in Berkeley if you had a military base mm-hmm. here. The newspapers, the preachers, and everybody would say, oh my God, save our jobs. We need to keep open the sewer gas campus bomb disposal base or something of that sort. It goes on endlessly. I've said it before, but I think it's apropos. The state of Washington has two really lovely women, relatively liberal senators, who have represented their state well. Say the word Boeing to them, and before your very eyes, they will turn into bloodlusting fascist hyenas.
Sounds like Feinstein.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, their function is to keep Boeing in business. The military industrial complex is very good at this sort of thing. On a big project like the B-2 bomber, they put a piece of that in as many constituencies as they possibly can. It sort of runs the price up terribly, too. Just so that if anybody got the idea, any man or woman in Congress, that we didn't need a new weapon of mass destruction, they could be put out of office the next election by firing a good many of their constituents. This is what I'm in the book calling military Keynesianism. It certainly wasn't an idea of John Maynard Keynes. It's not what he meant by it. But it does refer to the use of the defense budget, so-called, or the military establishment's funds, which is considerably more than the Department of Defense, for purposes of maintaining as close to full employment as possible to influence the level of employment in the society, to make work, and to live with the vicious cycle that it sets up. That is, bigger weapons mean more wars mean bigger weapons, so that we go to war with great regularity now.
Well, that's why I wanted to add to the military-industrial congressional complex the academic component of that, and particularly because we are here in Berkeley. As you probably know, the University of California has two top secret campuses, one of them not even in California, Los Alamos. They were deliberately set up by Edward Teller and Ernest Lawrence to compete with one another to produce the very best means of mass destruction. And
the interesting thing, though, is that you're seeing the university as still playing a malevolent role, whereas my thought would have been that there was a disastrous failure of the universities, particularly in the social sciences, in the 1990s. I mean, I was a former member of the Council on Foreign Relations. I actually resigned over Sam Huntington's article about the clash of civilizations. I was told bluntly, no one ever resigns from the Council of Foreign Relations, they die. and I said, well, I'm resigning because I'm not dead yet. But nonetheless, they went 5 years without ever publishing a single article on Iraq. I mean, and what went wrong? A lot of things have gone wrong. The way in which fundraising has devolved from trustees to deans and people like that, who are actually rather good at it, enjoy it, find it easier than performing their function of quality control over very complex institutions like departments. That is to say, the failure is not just one of malevolence or of vested interests. I also think it has been a rather serious intellectual failure in not doing this sort of work that would have contributed to oversight of the government, democratic controls, this sort of providing the kind of information that the professoriate would be able to do and that the public certainly could use.
Mm-hmm. Well, as long as we're talking about economics, let's talk about your idea of military Keynesianism. Many of these neocons, of course, just detest Franklin Roosevelt, see him as something close to Satan. Would you compare the kind of Keynesianism that produced schools, airports, roads, sewers, etc., with the kind of Keynesianism that we have now?
Yes, well, John Maynard Keynes, I particularly admire him, very famous English economist and of enormous influence. One of the things I always loved, particularly given my background as a consultant of the CIA, many people have asked, what on earth happened to you? Boy, did you change your mind. And I think you're being inconsistent. Keynes, when once accused of being inconsistent, rather famously said, when I get new information, I change my position. What, sir, do you do with new information? Some of the new information I got was how fast after the collapse. I mean, there's no question, I was a cold warrior. I thought the Soviet Union was a menace, I still do. But that it was astonishing how remarkably rapidly after the collapse of the Soviet Union, our government set out to find a replacement enemy, to keep the military-industrial complex at work. China, drug lords, terrorism, even instability. Isn't that we needed a defense establishment for that, too. Keynesianism, this was, Keynes's idea was when the economy is so depressed that simply people don't have enough money to buy anything with, buy anything at all, that it's important to start putting money in the hands of consumers. And he proposed counter-cyclical job creation. Some of it was, he thought was, were great ideas. The Triboro Bridge, the Grand Coulee Dam, all of those sorts of things that were part of American Keynesianism. But he also said we should just do make work, put money in disused mines and pay unemployed workers to go down and dig it up. At least gives them something to do, and we'll start getting the economy back in place. He also genuinely meant it as counter-cyclical. We do this in times of depression, but when we'd regained a degree of employment, we would then go back to ending deficit spending and pay down the budget, things of this sort. That's certainly one of the changes in military Keynesianism. It never stops. I mean, once you get hooked on living off of munitions making, there is no cure. There is no backing down from it. I mean, we spent well over $5 trillion on nuclear weapons between the 1940s and the height of the stockpile in 1966. One was never used, except for the two in Japan. But it's a perfect example of Keynesianism, spending a huge amount of money to put people to work, none of it having ever showing up in the military budget. This is the Department of Energy, which is entirely separate and never included when Rumsfeld goes around telling you what a small and declining percentage of gross domestic product the military budget is. This is the kind of nonsense that the press accepts when there are geniuses in Washington that could explain it to you in a half hour and they write good books on the defense budget. Most of them actually work for the Republican Party in the budget committees. The simple appropriation, simple. It's $750 billion right now. It's larger than all other defense budgets on Earth combined. And that's the straightforward appropriation, including the funding for two wars. But then you're starting adding in nuclear weapons. You add in the entire separate budget for defense facilities, that is 737 American military bases abroad, leave aside the ones domestically. Defenders of the Pentagon like to say, oh, you're wrong. You're just talking about Marine guards in embassies. I guarantee you there aren't any 737 embassies anywhere. There aren't that many countries. The largest items in the military establishment that is never accounted for is interest payments on the debt on all the previous wars. That's in the Treasury Department, of course. Then we have the whole issue of veterans benefits and treatment of the remarkable veterans from Iraq who have survived wounds that normally would have killed them and has now led to this scandal, another scandal of remarkable incompetence. But the costs of paying for our wounded are simply skyrocketing. That's, of course, in the Department of Veterans Affairs, not in the Pentagon. Foreign military sales is done by the State Department. So once you start looking throughout the government at all the things that add up, military Keynesianism doesn't sound quite as outré as it may coming from me.
You are listening to an interview of Chalmers Johnson, author, scholar, and critic of U.S. empire building. Chalmers Johnson died in November 2010, and this 2007 program is dedicated to his memory.
Well, in the book, you talk about how things like the Star Wars, so-called Star Wars, yes, defense system, is better. It really doesn't matter whether we use it or not. I mean, it, right, serves the function of using up a lot of money.
Yes.
But it looks like we're about to have another spasm, and I'd like to wrap up with talking about our drive towards war with Iran. The Sunday Times of London reported that it had a report showing that there are advanced Israeli plans to launch a nuclear strike on Iran. Well, you combine this with Seymour Hersh's articles, yes, and I just wondered if you could say something about Israel's role in this kind of imperial cosmology. And
well, of course, Israel is a ward of the United States, and we are determined to protect it. It's written in, it's part of our defense budget, is the several billion dollars annually that goes to Israel, and with relatively few controls over how the money is spent. Moreover, as an Israeli attack on Iran is an Israeli-American attack, just as the famous Israeli attack on the reactor at Oserak, we laid down a radar trail where our F-16s, that Israeli pilots were flying, to get there and hit the thing properly. The Israelis have asked for a new one. I mean, they would like to have a new electronic map put on the ground to guide them to Iran. It's hard to explain the enthusiasm for amateur military theorizing in Washington these days over this kind of thing. What's happening in the case of Iran is relatively simple. We have to learn to live with a nuclear Iran. There is no alternative. We set it up. Iran is a large and important country. It's surrounded by nuclear powers. The Soviet Union to the north, the United States in the Persian Gulf, Israel in the west, India and Pakistan on its borders. And then along comes a president who says that he's committed to preventive war. We, of course, attacked the one that we knew didn't have nuclear weapons. And that's precisely what we're talking about here. The only way you could defend yourself against such a threat, which is now made credible by the invasion of Iraq and what has actually occurred there, is to have a retaliatory capacity. As de Gaulle put it, the ability to tear off an arm. That will slow the Americans down. Everybody knows that. I mean, we used to say that that's what had happened in North Korea. They didn't actually have a bomb. They just went around and they painted buckets red and wrote atom bomb on it. And and the news took care of the rest. That they were always extremely rational people that saw what they were facing. And their answer to this, as it's Churchillian, the Americans say they're going to attack us. Well, if you've got to go, take one with you, as Churchill said at the height of the Blitz. And if the Americans are going to attack us, we intend to take out the city of Seoul, as many American military bases in Okinawa as we possibly can, as many Japanese cities as we can. They don't have much of a capacity to do that, but it is now become a credible threat. At the same time, there's nothing easier to deter than a thing like that. The easiest thing on Earth is to tell where a nuclear-tipped missile came from. We have the capacity, technological, we don't even have to depend on any employee to know where it came from. And if a country, if Israel were attacked by Iran would disappear the next day. I see, and I think we've known for some time, that Iran will be relatively easily deterred from ever using its weapon, but that it will stop this nonsense of the Israelis believing that they are beyond, that they are like us, beyond all forms of international law, capable of exercising anything they want to do in the name of raison d'etat and maintaining this gross and overwhelming military power, contemptuous of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That is the tragedy of our playing along with Israel, tolerating the kinds of things that they have been doing, is that it probably affects Israeli security more severely than anything else. They get themselves more and more isolated all the time. The old nation in arms doesn't work very well anymore. It's just extremely dangerous situation. the signs of life in the country are that we are told, this is the few smart journalists who work for the Washington Post and who follow the Pentagon closely, that an attack on, an American attack, or an ordered attack on Iran will lead to a high command mutiny in the American armed forces. That seems like a distinct possibility right now. They're actually in some way so disgusted by their very hard work after Vietnam to try and rebuild the military and then to have it as thoroughly discredited. I mean, right now, this huge high-tech military with 150,000 troops in Iraq has been fought to a standstill by 20,000 insurgents equipped with homemade bombs. Mm-hmm. You would have thought there would be grounds for an investigation here. Where did
so
the money
many other
go?
Things. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, let's wind up on an upbeat note. You said that Nemesis is in the house and we're facing bankruptcy. So when do you think it's going to come, and should I buy gold?
Well, bear in mind, those in the audience here who are graduate students in economics at this great university will be aware that what they've been taught about international trade hasn't been true of the United States for a very long time. That is, the world's leading net debtor nation, generally speaking, is just common sense to not go around insulting your banker that often if you are the world's largest net debtor. But we are dependent upon the Chinese and the Japanese continuing to ship huge amounts of money to us every day in order to keep up our lifestyle. When will this happen? When they decide they don't want to take dollars anymore? It could happen at this moment if Saudi Arabia decided tomorrow that they wanted to be paid in euros instead of dollars for oil. The United States would collapse right then and there. It would be over. Owarimashita. I'm breaking into Japanese.
Feel free.
And right now, all holders of dollars on Earth are quietly, secretively trying to cut their holdings, because once it's apparent what's happening, then the name of the game is don't be the last guy through the door, because by the time you're the last one through the door, this stuff is junk. That could happen. People in economics departments have been taught for at least 50 years that with a current account deficit of, say, 3% of gross domestic product, you're an economy in very serious trouble and must have corrective measures at once to wean you off of foreign goods. Well, our current account deficit is at 6% of GDP, and it continues to go ahead as an unbelievably rigged system. You don't know when it's going to happen because it serves so many other people's interests. The Chinese and the Japanese decide to continue to accept more or less disvalued American money in order to continue to maintain high employment in their societies and to continue to develop this industrial base. We don't manufacture much anymore these days except weapons and munitions, and they know that.
We make good ones.
Actually, they're really rather crappy.
They fooled us again.
The chapter that I'm really pleased with in Nemesis is the one on space, the ultimate imperialist project.
The gravel.
Well, yes, and it's interesting to see the Chinese retaliate. Finally, after we've tried desperately, they've tried. People around the world have tried desperately to get the Americans on board to actually begin to prevent through serious international law, the weaponization of space. Of all the things, all the countries that should be interested in this, it's us. We depend on this stuff. I mean, every time you buy anything with your credit card at Walmart or whatever else, whammo, it goes up to a high Earth orbit, gets punched up. Walmart notes that we have one fewer sock than we used to have, or something of that sort. They go on endlessly, is what television depends on it. And now here we are filling up the low Earth orbits with whizzing debris. There are a lot of people predicting, the Johnson Space Center said it's perfectly possible that within a few years the entire planet will simply be enclosed in debris, flying at 17,500 miles an hour, the speed of the shuttle, and space exploration will, for all intents and purposes, cease. We'll never get through it again. Sally Ride, as you may remember, was the commandant of the Challenger before its ultimate unfortunate end. But when she was commandant on, I guess it was her second Challenger flight, a piece of paint hit the windshield on the thing, and she said, "I just became panic-stricken." I mean, that is the gouge made out of the window. I thought, this thing will not withstand reentry. It did, and they survived it. The amount of debris is huge. In fact, there's a great deal of strategizing today on what a really rogue nation could totally blind the United States. There goes global positioning systems. Every pledge, cell phone around would end at once by just firing just firing a couple of truckloads of gravel in the low Earth orbit and let it spin around and kill all our satellites. All of a sudden, no more electronic battlefield or anything else. Mm-hmm. We're dependent on this stuff.
Well, on that note of hope, particularly if we can just get rid of television, I think that's a great idea. Thank you, Chalmers.
Of course. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You heard the second part of a one-hour interview of Chalmers Johnson, author of the trilogy Blowback, Sorrows of Empire and Nemesis. First broadcast in 2007, this conversation is broadcast again to honor the memory and legacy of Chalmers Johnson. He died, age 79, in November 2010. His interviewer, Gray Bracken, is the author of Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. Chalmers Johnson taught political science at the University of California, Berkeley, and San Diego until he retired in 1992. He's best known for his scholarship on Japan and for his time as consultant for the CIA. He left the CIA after a visit to the military base in Okinawa, where a 12-year-old Japanese girl had just been abducted and raped by two U.S. Marines. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.